Sir, the possibility of successfully navigating an asteroid field is approximately 3,720 to 1.
Never tell me the odds.
I'm Pete Mitchell. He's Peyton Jones. And this is the Church Planner Podcast.
Hey, Church Planner, this is Pete Mitchell.
And this is, when you say it like that, it's kind of final, isn't it?
Well, it's funny because we don't have a topic for today, at least not yet. And all I was thinking is the very first thing I wanted to let out of my mouth is, and today we're going to talk about so-and-so, which is the very person who last time we did a podcast, you're like, yeah, we got to cut that out. We can't mention anything about that guy.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's where my mind goes, right? Like, I want to make things really difficult on friends. So let's go talk about something we can't talk about.
Well, this is Peyton Jones. We're going to talk with Pete Mitchell and Peyton Jones, but we're not going to talk about anybody today, Pete, except for Jesus.
You just wait. I'm gonna wiggle something in there.
I know you are. So let's talk smack. I'll think of a topic because here's the problem, right? Like I've been in an all-day meeting. I've been recording for Discipology, cha-ching, and I got some audio guides coming up for Through the Word app. We're going to be partnering with them, and very exciting. And I have to start doing front-facing stuff again like I used to back when I had no money. And when you have no money, social media is like the way, right? And so I've got to get back into that now because I got a book coming out and I'm going to be talking about
it. You know when it comes out, by the way?
Yeah, St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, nice.
March 17th. Why askest thou?
Because I didn't know when it came out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good reason.
I know I'm not getting a review copy, so I'm going to have to buy it like everybody else.
I know. I didn't ask you to endorse it either.
Wait. I'm going to have to buy it like everybody else and then stick it on my shelf and never read it, just like all the other books I have from you.
You know, it's funny you say that because I think Plantology gets read. this one, it'll be interesting because the journal will be used. Like I created a system with a tool, you know. The journal is a tool. It's really exciting. And the app is, we're digital discipleship. We're really blazing the trail here and creating something kind of neat. So that's cool. I can't wait, man. But anyways, probably next week I'll just be talking mobilization from now on. Like so much is just going to be, because the whole thing is basically that mobilization is what disciple making is all about, and that you can have if you don't have time teaching and then tactics, you don't have mobilization. No matter what you call it, it's not mobilization. You might have discipleship, but until you add the tactical rhythm, you haven't moved into disciple making yet. And so it's probably going to be a big focus up until the book launches. So just, buckle your seatbelt, everybody. And Pete, let me hear that Chewbacca roar.
I got no phlegm in the back of my throat. I don't know. That's just
come on, buddy, punch it. Let's go. I remember what Han Solo says. Yee-hoo! He says that, right? But I don't know. Buckle in, kid. It's about to get bumpy.
So, yeah, that's great, wonderful. Now back to me and I want to talk about.
All right.
So yesterday, I watched the interview, the podcast interview with my old college roommate, the one I was telling you about.
Oh,
the
yeah.
Navy SEAL that was on the Bin Laden raid.
How'd that go?
I thought it was a really good interview.
Did he mention you? Was he like, I wasn't sure of myself or very confident. And then I roomed with Pete Mitchell. And after that, I decided to become a Navy SEAL. I realized my full potential.
Exactly what he said. So you watched it.
Yeah, I did. And I saw like where he's like, I have this picture of Pete on my gun.
Did you catch the part where he said, and I really used Pete as my example of who I wanted to be in life.
Yes.
And that's why I knew I could be a Navy SEAL.
Yeah, there was that one part of the interview where he said, you know, in the darkest of times, you know, like we'd be pinned down on a crossfire and when an operation went wrong, and I'd just pull out my picture of Pete, and I'd ask myself, what would Pete do in this situation? And he said it was almost like I could see his lips moving in the photo, going, "Be the best you could be." And he was like, "Now pulled me out. This saved many people's lives, including my own."
And that's why he also said, "That's why I often visit BetterCallPete.com."
That was a good segue,
dude. Love that domain. I don't know what I'm going to use it for, but I bought that domain. BetterCallPete.com.
Love that domain.
Oh, it's just love a good
that
one.
Joker. No, that's awesome, brother. So tell me about his interview. What happened in it?
Well, he was on the mission that got Bin Laden. There you go.
Dude, that's so rad. So you're like, is that 1 degree of separation from Osama Bin Laden? Is that what that makes it, or is that two?
You know, I don't really know how it all works, but he said on the interview, he put a couple rounds in Osama himself in the body, but he was already dead.
Oh, yeah, okay.
He said he was.
But just to say he did.
Honestly, he didn't say this, but my
I'm
thought
here,
has always been,
I've got a gun, I mean.
My thought has, you know, always been every single well. One of those guys walked by it and put a couple rounds in. That's been my theory for, you know, 14 years, however long it's been since it happened. But
yeah, the real reason why they disposed of the body immediately.
Because it was Swiss cheese by the time.
Yeah, there's probably nothing left.
But it was a really good interview. It was really fascinating. And hearing all the crap that he's gone through by the government, right? Because he did the book, he did No Easy Day. But apparently what happened, according to him, right? So here's the thing too. You got to realize everything is from someone's point of view. So there's two sides to every story. He originally hired some former JAG SOCOM lawyer, right, who was now in private practice, who had represented, I think, a dude who did Delta and came out with his book. And so this lawyer said, "Hey, I can officially review your book for you and, you know, make sure that there's no classified stuff in it." And that, you know, because of, I don't know, he didn't really say why, but the guy's, you know, the guy's a former JAG officer for Special Forces. So Matt is like, okay, cool. And then, of course, what does he get in trouble for? Well, they said, well, first of all, they said, the government said, oh, well, he released all kinds of classified material in his book, which they later finally admitted, no, you didn't. But what they finally tagged him for was they said, well, you didn't get pre-publication approval. So during all of the lawsuits with the government, you know, they got to do discovery. So they found out from the government, how much had you actually talked to my original lawyer? Well, the original lawyer, they had only talked to him for 15 minutes. And the original lawyer said, well, I told him he needed to get pre-approval. And it's like the exact opposite of what he told him, right? Now, this is, again, according to Matt, right? So two sides to every story. I have no idea what the other guy's story is. However, so Matt sues his former lawyer, does the whole rigmarole, right? Finally, 2.5 years later, about ready to go to trial the next day. And the guy goes, okay, I'll just settle with you. And admits that he gave him bad advice. And so he went back to the government and said, see, I didn't do anything. You guys have all my emails. I've waived my attorney-client privilege. Because I wanted to prove to you guys, I was trying to do everything correct. And here, I even won a malpractice lawsuit. Here's the money from the malpractice lawsuit. And the government's like, yeah, we still don't care. We want every dime you got paid on the book. And he had to use $1.5 million of it to defend himself against the government. So he didn't have that money. It's not like he spent it on himself. He literally didn't have it. And so he goes, yeah, I'm on a payment plan right now. I'm paying the government $3,800 a month for the next 15 years. And he goes, if I miss one payment, they said they're going to come after me. So he's just like, I'm like, that's, by the way, that's longer than he served in the military. He served for 14 years.
Wow.
He never made $1.5 million, but he's going to spend the next 15 years paying the government back $1.5 million. And he was contrasting us against all of the guys who are writing books that don't get pre-approval.
Wow.
And like, there's this, you've probably seen him. There's Dan Crenshaw, who's a former Navy SEAL congressman. And so he's talking to Dan Crenshaw and he's like, well, sir, you know, you got to get pre-approval. And he goes, no, I know how to not put anything in there that's, you know, sensitive or top secret or anything. And he's like, I didn't put anything in mine that was sensitive or top secret. And they came after me. The difference is position, right? Like he was an enlisted guy and all these other guys are like directors of the CIA, admirals. You know, Dan Crenshaw's a congressman. They don't get in trouble.
Wow.
So it's like, he's pointing out the hypocrisy, the two standards. Us enlisted guys, we don't get to do it. But you guys, you can do it. You can break the rules and there's no repercussions for you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was a fascinating interview. And like he even said, you know,
where was it, by the way? Where can I watch it?
Oh, it's the Sean Ryan show, the Sean Ryan podcast.
Right.
So I saw it on YouTube so I could see the whole, you know, kit and caboodle there. Mm-hmm. It was really good. Cause he mentioned that, you know, he was suicidal. He goes, you know, I had a gun in my mouth several times because the government was coming after me. He's like, I did everything I was supposed to do.
That's tough. Coming after me. That's tough, man.
Yeah. And I mean, he, you know, his dad was a missionary or his parents were missionaries in Alaska. That's how I met him, right? Because we went to Bible college together.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just like, yeah. So it's interesting. It's interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. Wow. Well, it's unfortunate that, you know, we say, right, like this is a week of Veterans Day and we say, hey, thanks for your service and we appreciate you so much. But, we've always kind of treated our veterans, poorly. I mean, we really, from day to day, like having the holidays, like it's not the same, you know, like you have no idea what these guys paid. Like $1.5 million in this guy's pocket is nothing compared to what, cause he suffers. Like, I don't care what you say, combat infantry, Navy SEAL. I don't care. The human brain is not designed to do that. Even the guys are like, oh, I'm rock hard and I love it. And you know, blah, blah. They're masking trauma, you know, like, it was Steinbeck who actually said the patriotism that we show the veterans is, and this is, you know, for me, like my stepdad was, in Vietnam, killing people in the jungles, right? Like he had crazy PTSD. He was Air Force, whatever their special forces is. He was doing something there. I remember something about communications and, you know, like communication towers. He was doing something with those, but he was out there killing people. And he was messed up. My brother was messed up. My grandfather rarely ever talked about the stuff he did in the 101st Airborne, but like these guys were all messed up, man. Like good people, all of them good people, but except for my stepdad. The thing is, man, is that, Steinbeck in his book, East of Eden, points out that the reason we do the parades and we have all this like sentimental, like, you know, is because deep down we know what we're asking them to do. We're asking them to do the unthinkable. We're asking to do things that the average human being is not wired for and will cause a lifetime of suffering and regret. That's the price tag. And we pay them so little for it that we have to give them all these honors. And I'm not saying those honors are not deserved, but Steinbeck's perspective of it was because of the horror that we put them through and asked them to commit, we therefore have to venerate them and honor them to compensate.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
No, it does, because a lot of the interviews, like Sean Ryan, that's his thing, is he interviews mostly, not entirely, but mostly special forces dudes, and not just U.S. special forces, like other countries as well. And that's a common thread that comes up, is the trauma that they've gone through mentally. And but physically as well. Like one of the things that Matt talks about So on that mission with Bin Laden, he was on the helicopter that crashed. And
that's crazy.
His neck got jacked up. And so he's been seeing the VA for years, and all he's needed is an MRI.
Yeah.
And he can't get an MRI.
Isn't that crazy?
And he's like, no, I don't know if it's just because the VA is that bad, or it's because word has come down from on high, don't help this guy because he's been in so much trouble with the government, right? And he goes, so, and he mentions the doctor's name is some former Air Force surgeon or something like that, who's in private practice now. And he goes, so I went in, I see the guy, I get x-rayed, I get MRI, do my exam, everything. I get a call like the next day, and he goes, we are scheduling surgery in a week. He goes, you don't understand. You got an 8 millimeter difference between, you know, this vertebrae and that one. He goes, you hit the wrong speed bump, you're going to be paralyzed for the rest of your life.
Wow.
And he goes, I've had 5 surgeries by this guy, you know, fixing my neck. And he goes, and he hasn't charged me a dime.
Really?
Yeah.
That's so cool, man.
And it's like, but you contrast that to like, why wasn't the VA taking care of this? Was it because the VA is that bad, which is what we hear about, right? We hear the horror stories of the VA. Or was it because, I mean, his stuff went as high as Obama. Like, Obama was the reason why they went after him.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because
well, that's interesting, because Obama's usually pretty good in the military. From
yeah, but see, Matt ruined it when he came out with his book before Zero Dark Thirty and Obama's book that they did all their interviews for, you know.
Oh, okay. All
and right. So, and it contradicted a lot of what they were saying. And so that's why they were going after him, because it was like he blew up their whole plan of attack, if you will, using the Bin Laden raid to get reelection.
Yeah.
And but I mean, it's just, yeah, it's really interesting, you know, because I think probably at this point, everybody knows at least one veteran. Like, how do you not,
right,
after 20 years of constant war? And then I look at where we're at in the state of the world today, and I'm like, okay, it's just a matter of time before another war pops off. I mean, we already got the whole thing going on in Ukraine where we're doing a proxy war with Russia. You know, what happens when it pops off? Yeah. Or what happens when, like, you even look at our own country, because you and I have talked about this, like, we're in a cold civil war right now. What happens when the thing heats up and it becomes a hot civil war? I mean, man, it's, we got some crazy craziness ahead of us as a world, for sure. And to me, too, the other thing that's really scary is because technology has reached the point where it is. Like, I was seeing something earlier this week on these new jets that they have, basically full-size jets that go ahead of the manned jets. And I'm like, yeah, now we got drone warfare where, you know, no human life on our side, but we can literally bomb the heck out of someone else.
Right.
And that's scary to me. It's not scary to me, like, from a defensive standpoint. It's scary to me that that's where the world has gone, because that means the enemy can do it, too. Right. Like, right now, yeah, sure, Afghanistan doesn't have the money to create the drones, but Russia does, China does, a lot of European countries do, and that's scary to me. That's really scary.
Some people think Paul just worked with his hands, and he did, but he also raised funds. Don't believe me? Check out Philippians 4, 1 Corinthians 10, and Romans 15. In fact, when the kingdom of God catapulted forward, there was usually a kingdom-minded businessman or woman behind it, like Priscilla and Aquila. If you're going to raise funds, though, do it well. Our partners, Reliant, can help you put rocket fuel in your fundraising tank. I wish I'd had this when I was church planning, but Reliant can partner with you to get you the training and coaching you need to raise that support, as well as provide you with employment services you may need, like payroll, health benefits, and more. To learn more, check out Reliant.org/CPP.
They
well, you know, once. You've kind of given me an idea for our podcast today. Woohoo! You know, like End Times is making the rounds quite a bit on...
Here it is.
Yeah, on social media. I mean, you know, I had my daughter send me the other night something on Revelation, what the four horsemen were, and... She was like, your thoughts? And I'm like, okay. So the young people were really thinking about this stuff. And there's a lot of crazy stuff going around. Like, for example, everybody knows I'm back on Instagram now. After like 2-3 posts that I ever made.
I know you're back on Instagram and I hate you for it.
Because I send, you got to admit, they're pretty funny, the stuff that I send you. It's pretty good.
Well, what's so funny to me is one time Vinny asked me, he goes, how do you always have, like, because I'm not going to say what it is. It was nothing bad, right? Just so the audience knows. But he'd be like, how do you always have these reels that you send me that are like so consistent on the same topic?
Yeah.
And it's because of the stinking algorithm, right? So that's why your algorithm is like, I can tell by what you're sending me, your algorithm is.
Oh my gosh, dude. It is just hilarious. There's one, did you see the one with Yoda where he's like, there is no try? And he's singing opera.
Yeah, you sent it to me. Thank you.
Oh my gosh, that was fun. I pulled that up in our team meeting yesterday and was just laughing my butt off. And Ryan comes back into the room because I waited till he went to the bathroom, right? Because you got to behave when Ryan's running your meeting. But he's like, you guys, it's like leaving five-year-olds. He comes back in. We're all tying and watching Yoda sing an opera. There is no try, only do. That was great. So anyways, but you know, my favorite ones right now are about dispensationalism. And it's like these, they look like they're from The Chosen, and it's Jesus walking with some disciples, and like behind them, the temple's burning. They're like, Lord, when will the sign of these things be? He's like, don't worry about it. This is for a guy named Bob who's going to be watching Fox News 2,000 years from now. Nothing to do with you guys. Don't worry. And they're like, oh, whew, good, right? So those are my favorite. And there's ones that attack dispensationalism a little bit. And they're just funny.
So explain to me what dispensationalism is.
So dispensationalism is an end times theology that really got traction. I mean, it didn't exist until like the pre-rapture and all that. And it teaches us that there are two different ways that God deals with his people. He deals a certain way with the Jews and a certain way with the Gentiles. Now, I am not trying to strawman this, but at its basic, you're going to be like, once you learn what dispensationalism is, you're like, wait a second, that can't be right. No, it is. Basically, it says that God has two different ways of dealing with people. He deals with the Jews totally differently than he deals with the Gentiles. So some people will be like, oh, of course, yeah. Like, of course he does, because there's chosen people, right? Well, when you get into the New Testament, in the book of Ephesians, Paul says you were chosen Gentiles, not you, Bob, were chosen before the foundation of the world. You as Gentiles were chosen as well before the foundation of the world. So like if God chose Abram, back in Genesis 11:12, he chose you before the foundation of the world. You weren't. So dispensationalism teaches that God's efforts to the Jews failed, that the law failed. So sending Jesus was, and I know, it, listen, when he gives the law, it's supposed to be they live that out. When they don't live it out, God has to send Jesus to save them. But they reject him. So then it goes into the time of the Gentiles. And the only reason that God is reaching out and working through the Gentiles is to incite the Jews to jealousy. That the whole salvation plan of you and I, Pete, was eventually to win back Israel. But God can only deal with one covenant people at a time. So he has to rapture the church out of the way. And in the time of the Gentiles, in order to then get back to business with the Jews during the tribulation and save some and restore them back.
Really?
And then they will come. I swear to you, that is the view. So, like, if you grew up,
their
like,
God is that weak, he can only handle one group of people at a time.
Well, because it's the time of the Gentiles. So, like, you know, God's got a dispensation. The dispensation means that he has a way of working at different dispensations in time. And now that we're in the age of the Gentiles, he's working through grace, through faith, and then he'll go back and he'll introduce Jesus because they broke the law. And then they'll be like, oh, we broke the law. Oh, we need Jesus now. Oh, okay. And then they'll receive salvation as well. So there's hints of like Romans you can hear in that, but it's a completely different interpretation than if you read the Bible and you're like, no, like for example, and this is important, right? Because as like social media can be a really good tool and a really bad tool. So for example, it can spread heresy really, really fast. It can spread all the weirdness, right? One of those videos, it goes, Lord, how will we know the end is upon us? And Jesus goes, well, there's going to be a red heifer born in Texas. It's going to be pretty big and hit the news. You'll know then that I'm about to come, right? Or Jesus goes, there'll be a blood moon. These happen every 25 years or whatever it is, you know? And it's just funny because you hear all of a sudden all the crazy, wacky stuff that Christians say when they get all weird about it. And these little videos on TikTok are just, or Instagram or whatever it is, are just ripping on this bad theology, right? And how we're doing the opposite of what Jesus said. 80-70, like one of the things when it shows the temple burning to the ground, they're like, Lord, is this what you were talking about? And Jesus is like, no, I know it sounds kind of like when I said, this generation will see this, or, you know, the temple will be destroyed. But don't worry, there's going to be another one built one day. Hasn't, you know, 2,000 years from now, they'll still be waiting for that temple to be built, but don't worry, it's going to happen. And they just keep making fun of it because what if what Jesus said in Matthew 24 was fulfilled when he said, I tell you, there will some standing here will not taste death before the end comes. Right? If we're talking about a dispensation ending, it was the time of the sacrifices, right? It was Daniel. The sacrifices will be done away with. Like all that happened in 80-70, right? Like the old system died and now the Jews don't have anything. That's where Paul's like, hey, listen, we're going to incite them to jealousy that God is going to move to the Gentiles. He's going to make them his people. He's going to graft them in, and they're grafted in only in time, right? It wasn't like, oh, well, you know, the Jews didn't come to me, so I guess I got to go work with the Gentiles now. You know, it's plan B. I mean, sorry, Pete, but you know, but Paul completely combats that. Because the Gentiles felt like second-class citizens. That's what he said. No, hey, if Abraham was chosen, Genesis 11, 12, you were chosen for the foundation of the world. You were always in God's heart, always in God's mind, right? The Gentiles are not an afterthought. So good theology or good scriptural exegesis will contradict all this. But God's only had one way of ever working with people. Because the alternative to that theology is something called covenant theology, which the Reformed people have. And covenant theology teaches there are two ways that God worked as well, but there were two covenants. So like dispensationalism believes there are multiple covenants. There was an Adamic covenant for Adam, you know, like obey and you'll live. And Paul talks about this, right? Then there was the Noahic covenant. You know, because God, it says in the Abrahamic covenant, the Davidic covenant makes covenant, you know, boom, boom, boom. But the Mosaic covenant, the law, that there's all these different, and they would say it's stages and different ways God works. But there was a guy that came along. His name was D.P. Fuller. Believe it or not, his middle name was Peyton, Daniel Peyton Fuller. And D.P. Fuller was John Piper's mentor, actually, heavily influenced by C.S. Lewis, but he was a diehard dispensationalist. And he kind of one day realized, wait a second, and by the way, Fuller Institute was founded by his dad, Charles Fuller. And D.P. Fuller was a really different dude, like absolutely started out conservative, went a bit liberal at times. He was in it. I remember talking to one of his colleagues, New Testament professor there. And he said, yeah, Daniel Payton Fuller's a bit of a mystery wrapped in an enigma. But he was hard to figure out. In fact, John Piper used to always have him come speak at his stuff and then distance himself from him because as he went on, he got more and more liberal. But he wrote a fantastic book that absolutely changed my theology because as a reform guy back then, I was into covenant theology and the two covenants that reform people believe, and this is the counter to dispensationalism. There's the covenant of works and the covenant of faith. Covenant of works was in the garden when God told Abraham, you know, you if you eat of this tree, you will die. And so they call that the covenant of works. Well, Daniel Payton Fuller comes along and says, no such thing. God would have never, even in man's unfallen state, made a covenant of works, righteousness, that you become righteous by what you do. And so he said, look, it's just not, it's not who God is. If he had done that in the beginning, what's to stop him from doing that later? So what Daniel Payton Fuller said was there's only ever been one covenant from the beginning of time, and that's the covenant of faith. So just like you and I are saved by faith, right? Saved by grace through faith. Our covenant's faith. Even the Old Testament, they weren't saved by the law. Like, that's ridiculous. Law can't save anyone, Paul said. But many were saved. Why were they saved? Because they have faith. They just trusted God. You said to do this, and we put our trust in what you said. And we don't fully understand the sacrifice, but we understand that you're saying we have faith that you're taking care of our sins. And way back in the garden, he says that it was a covenant of faith. That when he told Adam, if you eat of this tree, you will die, what sustained him was faith and what God said. But when he fell, it was because he doubted. He doubted God's word. He doubted God's promise. He doubted God's goodness. So doubt was the reason for the fall. Faith was the reason. So the covenant, even in the garden, was a covenant of faith. It's only ever been one way that God has ever worked. And he wrote a book called The Unity of the Bible. And it basically just says, hey, God's always worked the same way. It's faith. It's trust in him. As our, even in our unfallen state, it was trusting God as his creation, trusting a creator. It was faith. And so when we fell, it was still the same. God went like, well, I guess that works plan didn't work so well. So when we come to the Jews and the Gentiles, dispensationalism, Paul says later, didn't the law do him any good? He says, no, because they didn't have faith, right? Did him no good. Without faith, the law is dead, right? Like you don't. Faith was the key. And he said, if they had mixed it with faith, they would have been fine. But they chose to actually trust in the letter of the law itself, and that damned them. So that's like a real potted theology of why dispensationalism doesn't work. Eventually you get into heresy. That's when you start getting into verses, right after Matthew 24, when he's talking about, you know, hey, the sign of the times and not one stone to be left upon another. And he's talking about AD 70. In the very next chapter, that's when he talks about the virgins and the oil in their lamp. That's when he talks about the talents. That's when he talks about, you know, all of these different verses where, you know, he's basically saying, be ready. But what we've done is we've made that like a sheep and the goats is in there too. We've made this like a works righteousness. If you go into everybody's interpretation, you're not going to heaven. You're going to miss the rapture because you're not good enough. You're not ready enough. Then it says things like, you're not going to go to heaven because you didn't, invest your talents. You bury them so you get to go to hell. Because at the end, he says hell. Or sheep and the goats. You don't get to go to heaven because you weren't righteous enough. I came to your door and you didn't feed me. You didn't clothe me. You didn't house me. Therefore, depart from me, you workers of iniquity. So all of a sudden, we make that about being ready for the rapture. And under that kind of theology, suddenly it's all about your works save you. And I can remember when I was teaching through this and through the Word, I ended that chapter and I had to change it because it offended so many people. But I said, yeah, my friends, we have a word for that. Whenever we teach it, we're saved by your works. And that word is heresy. And the audio guide ended that way. And people like wrote in like, hey, you know, like that's a cheap shot, man, to attack someone's theological end times view that way. And what I was saying was, I had to come back and correct it in a nice way, but it.
How did you correct it?
Well, I actually just said the same thing. I just didn't leave it with that kind of mic drop. You know, I still said the same thing. I just, you know me, like I have a way of saying things like a punk sometimes, you know, like Martin Luther with Doc Martens on, and I had to be a little more, who would the teacher be that I would liken it to? I had to be a little more Eugene Peterson about it, but I still had to say, you know, this is heresy, but I said it nicer. And still made the same point. And we have since had people write in and say, oh my gosh, thank you so much. That, yeah, it never made sense to me. Why, like, we're talking about what Jesus did for me and I'm saved by faith through grace. And all of a sudden, you know, I get to these passages about end times. It's like a completely different God, you know, like you're not good enough. You're not investing enough in me. I'm just going to ditch your butt in hell. Right. Whereas when you go back and you see the virgins and the lamps, Jesus is saying to them, hey, I've told you all this stuff. And let me tell you a parable now about people who they weren't ready. And I'm telling you, this stuff is coming. So he's talking to non-believers there. When he talks about the parable of the talents, first off, a talent means that it's like saying a dollar, right? Or the British pound sterling. Doesn't mean your talents and gifts and abilities. That's the first thing we do with that one. We make it about, oh, you didn't use your talents for God, your gifts. No, that's not what it's talking about. It's the master comes and says, I'm going to be back. Okay. But putting this deposit here for you to do something with. He's talking about the revelation of who Jesus was. Right. So when the judgment comes, when he comes back and he comes to collect, they're like, Lord, I took this revelation you gave me. And I invested it. Look, here's more. So they become believers, right? They're actually, these are our salvation passages. So, they take the degree of revelation and they have faith, right? They have faith in that he is what they've given him. They put it to work. They live by it, right? Now they're suddenly Christ followers. So when he comes back, he's like, yeah, I gave you this revelation. Look what you did with it. You followed me. Whereas, as opposed to, no, Lord, I just buried it. Like, yeah, it was great information, right? You can see that playing out all across the world, all throughout time. And then lastly, the sheep and the goats, that one is again, to non-believers. And if you read it carefully, if you do good exposition on that, Jesus says in the last days, God will gather the nations to himself, including Israel, including Rome, including you name it. And he says, on that day, they'll stand before me, the nations. And he says, I'll say, I came to you. Right. And I was hungry. I was this, I was that. You didn't clothe me. You didn't feed me when I was sick. It's how the world treated his people. Cause he says, whatever you did to the least of my brothers, he's talking about the disciples and the apostles and the missionaries, you did it to me. whatever you did not do to the least of my brothers. See, what we do is we turn that around. We make it to Christians. And we say, well, you know, what this passage is actually saying is, you, Pete, if you don't take care of homeless people, Jesus will say, you didn't take care of me. Depart from me, you worker of iniquity. It's not the passage. He's saying, I will separate the nations like the sheep and the goats, like a shepherd separates sheep from goats. And it's how they treat his people. The key of that is how they treat his people. So it's how they handle what the warnings Jesus gave about the coming judgment. It's how they handle the revelation that he gave to them. And it's how they handled his people, right? In light of all of this, in the persecution. All that stuff, completely different. Now I read through Matthew 25 and I'm like, okay, that's consistent. Not only with the chapter before it, but it's also consistent with the God I know and just the basic theology of my salvation, right? Now I don't suddenly have a God that just is like Allah, that suddenly just looks at me and says, I know my son died for you, but you know what? No, you didn't take care of the sick people enough. Go to hell. Does that follow?
It makes more sense. So what are some of the things that you're seeing pop up online about end times?
Well, there's a lot of mystical stuff about Revelation. And keep in mind that when COVID hit, you know, for us it threw the word, like Revelation popped, right? All of a sudden on YouVersion, like millions of people have listened to that thing. And Chris Lingham did a fantastic job. He's going to go back and redo it again at some point. But right now, there's kind of like this resurgence of end times interest. So the reason I'm bringing all of this up is I think most of us are like, yeah, Revelation, you know, it's the weird book, you know, like we don't. But non-believers are very interested in this. They're terrified of it, but they're really interested. So what I would say to church planners out there right now is just be aware. This is entering popular conversation. You ought to have an answer for everyone who asks you. Don't say, oh, well, you know, Revelation's kind of weird and it's a lot we don't understand, you know, because you're not boned up on it. I would say right now, if you can, like, bone up on it. And I would give you a few books because when people bring up some of these verses, you may say, well, you know, Revelation is what was, what is, and what was to come, or what is to come. So there's three. There are things that had already happened, things that are happening, and things that are going to happen. So like Christ is going to return, right? I'm not waiting for anything under my theology other than Jesus to come back. There's a possibility there still could be Antichrist based on Daniel, the little horn with the big mouth. But everything seems to have been fulfilled. That's the one that I always go, huh? And I was really helped by a number of books that I'll list out. If you guys want to read things that maybe will give you a different perspective. I know Pete's smart.
Sorry, no, I just thought of a really funny line that I was like, oh,
yeah, go.
I really like to say this.
Go on.
Well, I just happened to hear that Trump's got a little big horn or something like that. But I was like, oh, you can't say that because that'll offend half the.
I know. But, you know, it's okay to have fun about this stuff, right? Because you and I were having some interesting topics a little while ago. But I can tell you this. If you think the Antichrist is future, just remember what Jesus said. He'll deceive the elect. So whoever the church gets behind at some point, watch out, right? Like, that's all I'm saying, because if you believe there's a future Antichrist.
Yeah, but see, that's the thing is that, to me, that's a very easy thing to see because the church, and I'm being loose with the term church, is so big now.
Yeah.
There's always going to be someone who part of the church gets behind.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, yep. The church is huge.
Yeah.
What is it, like 2 billion people claim to be Christians in the world?
Yeah.
I mean, that's big. So, yeah. And again, you're not talking about necessarily Bible-believing Christians, right? We're talking about, you know, 2 billion people who, oh, yeah, sure, I go to church on Easter and Christmas. Right. Our pastor said the funniest line on Sunday. He goes, yeah, at our Christmas program, we like to let everyone know, by the way, we don't just meet at Easter, too. You can come back any other Sunday.
That's so good.
But yeah, so I mean, to me, I look at that and I'm like, does not surprise me, right? Doesn't surprise me.
No. Well, there's some books that are really good. R.C. Sproul. By the way, guys, I don't agree with any of these authors completely. There's futurists who believe everything's future and revelation, even now, like you read, you know, the Bible in one hand, newspaper in the other, Fox News and, you know, whatever, one eye on Fox News, one, that's all futurists. That's what they do. And they tend to be given to a lot of conspiracy theories. Sorry if I'm stepping on your toes, but you know, it's right. Right. You know what I'm saying is true. This is where you always find the people, oh, the red heifer born in Texas, you know, that we were referring to earlier. Oh, look over here, you know, since the 70s, right? 60s and 70s. Oh, a supercomputer in Sweden called the Beast. Its number is 666. It's this computer. Now people are coming. It's AI. It's going to be AI. That's the Antichrist. You know, the image that moves and talks and animates is now an AI robot. I saw that the other day. And you'll just see people saying, okay, until the next thing. Then it's going to be all this next thing. Now, here's the interesting thing. I mentioned a futurist. I'm what's called a historicist. So I would believe that these things play out in history over and over and over, like the great, you know, the Spanish Inquisition, right? That seemed very Antichrist. Counter-Reformation, very Antichrist. Like Hitler, you know, as John says, as we know the Antichrist is coming, even so many Antichrists have come. So Nero, right? Like, all these emperors, like he had seen Antichrist already. And he also meant by that false teachers. Who is the Antichrist? But he who denies that Jesus has come in the flesh. So he also thought Antichrist were false teachers. And of course, there's been an abundance of those, right? So it doesn't always have to be a world ruler. It's someone who deceives people is the Antichrist. Christ came as the light. The Antichrist comes and brings darkness and deception. So when a historicist would take like where Jesus says, when you see the abomination that causes desolation standing in the holy place, know that the time, you know, let the reader understand it's because it had happened during the 400 year silent period under Antiochus Epiphanes. And then it happened in AD 70. And Jesus with the gospel writers are saying, hey, let the reader understand like this happened already, but it's still, you know, like it repeats. And so when you get to a position in the Bible where you can see these things playing out, there's a cosmic war. That's what Revelation tells you. It's always playing out through history. Satan is always trying to kick off against God's people. So so a couple books, and then we'll sign off. But R.C. Sproul, The Last Days According to Jesus. George Eldon Ladd, wrote a really good one, and dang it, it's eluding me right now. More Than Conquerors by Hendrickson, amazing book, historicist interpretation of the book of Revelation. Because what you can do with that is you can go back and say, oh, hey, you may think this is all like nonsense. This stuff has already happened and it will continue to happen. So when you're able to go back to history and say, well, what was and what is to come is a historicist. That's the key to the book. That's how the book begins. The revelation of Jesus Christ, who revealed to him what was, what is, and what is to come. So that's kind of like the mindset of that book. But then when you look at a couple other books, real quick, Last Days Madness is the one that will absolutely exposit for you AD 70 in a whole new way. And then lastly, the one that I mentioned earlier, Daniel P. Fuller, Daniel Payton Fuller, The Unity of the Bible. That one is really good. If you just had those, you would be able to have really sane conversations about the end times, and you wouldn't be giving up anything. Jesus is still coming back in the flash of an eye, and believe, you know, like lightning, you know, is it like thief in the night? All that is still true. He came like a thief in the night in AD 70, by the way. Much of those things that he said, like two will be working in the field, one will be taken, another one left. To be left was good at AD 70. To be taken meant you were killed, right? So we think, you know, today, like the popular thing
is the rapture. Well, see, that's the thing to me is I'm like, because I saw one of those apologist pastors online, and he goes, the whole key to that verse is right before it. And he says, like, in the days of Noah.
Yeah.
And he goes, well, Noah was left. The bad people were taken. He goes, the key is right there. And we're trying to switch it and go, oh, the good people are taken. Then he goes, he literally gave us the key in the days of Noah.
And Revelation is still scary. Like, it's still a mystical, cosmic, scary book, you know, like I know people are thinking, hey, you're cheapening it. No, in fact, it's a little, you have more reverence and awe for it, because there's proof. Like Albert Schweitzer, for example, said, I can't believe, because everything Jesus said that would happen there. There's like 5 timestamp passages that tell you it's going to happen like during their lifetime in that chapter, 5 of them. And we just pretend they're not there. Well, this generation means 40 years and blah, blah, blah. And back then it meant, you know, no, we do all that weird stuff. It's like when you try to say God wants all men to be saved. Well, what does all men really mean? I think it means all men, right? Desires all men to be saved. You can do all kinds of theological backflips if you want. But he kind of said that for a reason. He would have said, well, you know, God wants some people to be saved if he were thinking like you. But he said what he said for a reason. So, you know, I think, when you get to, man, I probably offended half, probably 3/4, 5/6 of our audience now, Pete.
All right. The 3 people that listen, no one cares.
All right. Well, hey, man, I'm out of time because I got a jam. But guys, listen, it's a huge evangelistic opportunity for you. You're dealing with non-believers. Enter the conversation that they're having, like Pete says. Be a good marketer.
Well, here's the, I'll just leave this final question. How do you deal with your church finances when you have to deal with all this end time revelation and everything?
Well, with all that studying of all those books, Pete, I go to simplifychurch.com and they help me with.
Wait, who is this magical, mystical company?
Yeah, Simplify, not Simplify or SimplifoChurch.com, Pete. It's Simplify, and that's with a Y. SimplifyChurch.com. They'll help you with all your bookkeeping, tax complicity. I mean, end of year donor receipts, they'll handle it all for you, Pete.
That's so awesome. If only they had a good URL that was really easy to remember and I could go to.
Well, simplifychurch.com, Pete. And, you know, while you're at it, there's a lot of things people don't expect. You could even ask them, hey, will you help me sort out my end times theology? And tell them Pete and Peyton suggested that. That's the best. With that, guys, thanks for listening to the Church Planner Podcast. Pete, sign us out.
And remember, if you want to reach the ones that nobody's reaching, you've got to go where nobody's going and do what nobody's doing.